Welcome to Jay on Broadway for Tuesday, February 28th, 2017. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini.
And I am Broadway Star's James Marino.
James, I was going to do some sort of joke about the end of the Academy Awards here in our little banter section. I just don't have the energy for it. Like, I'm so emotionally drained from that whole situation that I just can't muster up any jokes at anyone's expense at this point. I'm just completely and thoroughly wiped. It's now 22 hours later.
I can appreciate that. So why don't we jump right into the Academy Awards? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I feel like I don't need to explain what happened at the end of the Academy Awards. Everyone's already, you know, seen it. Zapruder film analyzed everything about it. I had plenty of hot takes on my Twitter at like 1 a.m. on Monday morning, and then I continued for a while. Basically, my thought is I just feel bad for everybody. Like, obviously less bad for Moonlight because they ended up winning, but I feel bad for Warren Beatty, for Faye Dunaway. I feel bad for the cast and crew and producers of La La Land. I feel bad for Moonlight that they got robbed of that moment. But ultimately, I feel like from Joshua Horowitz, the producer of La La Land, to everybody involved with Moonlight, to Jimmy Kimmel, they all handled that. And even Warren Beatty, too, who, you know, he's a 79-year-old man who was put in a really tough situation in a huge spot on national television. And of course, we would have all liked to said, hey, I think I got the wrong envelope, but he's going to be 80 next month as, you know, things happen. So I feel like everybody handled it as best as they could. But, you know, it's just one of those I can't even imagine that roller coaster of emotions. So anyway, getting on to the stuff that's very theater specific, there were a ton of winners that have theatrical backgrounds. First, for costume design, Colleen Atwood, who did the costumes for Breakfast at Tiffany's on Broadway. She won for Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Obviously, Bench Pasek and Justin Paul began what I predict will be an EGOT win in just one calendar year. They got their first one with an Academy Award for City of Stars from La La Land for Best Original Song. Pulitzer Prize finalist Kenneth Lonergan won Best Original Screenplay for Manchester by the Sea, along with his director, Barry Jenkins. Terrell Alvin McCraney won for Adapted Screenplay in Moonlight. Terrell Alvin McCraney, I threw too many L's in there. He's a playwright that's been seen a lot at the Public. He wrote Head of Passes, that was off Broadway less than a year ago. Choir Boy, the brother and sister's play. So he's a really, really talented guy. Mahershala Ali won for Moonlight Best Supporting Actor. He was in Smart People at Second Stage last year. Obviously, two-time Tony winner Viola Davis, pulled off the rare double header of winning a Tony Award and an Academy Award for playing the same role in Fences as Best Supporting Actress. Damien Chazelle won for Best Director for La La Land, the movie musical. And, of course, former Sally Bowles, Emma Stone, won Best Actress for La La Land. A lot of theater people winning awards last night. And then there was a ton of theater people performing. Obviously, John Legend, who has not been on Broadway as a performer, he is currently represented on Broadway as one of the producers of Jitney. He performed the two nominated songs from La La Land. We also saw Lin-Manuel Miranda performing a short rap intro to the performance of How Far I'll Go, which he wrote from Moana, performed by Ali'i Krahalio. And pretty much as soon as she was done, everyone was trying to dreamcast her into things, from the eventual Hamilton movie that will be made probably about the time that she turns 25 or something, because she's 16. One thing to note, she did get hit in the head with one of these weird flags that Tommy Cale had people running around with that I guess was supposed to be the water and the wind. And the first thing that I thought of was poor old Bret Michaels almost getting decapitated at the Tony Awards a few years ago. You remember that? That's exactly what I thought of during, I think it was the Rock of Ages bit.
Yeah.
Rob Johnson will remember that, I'm sure. But then we also had the crazy thing of Seth Rogen and Michael J. Fox singing the Skylar Sisters song on the Academy Awards together. It was very fun. Overall, I thought the night was fantastic. I know a lot of people were very divided about how well or not well Jimmy Kimmel did. I thought he was fantastic. I thought he was great all night. I know a lot of people were saying, that he was talking down to, making jokes about these common people in the Hollywood elite were laughing at him. I thought the whole night was very well done. It's a super long ceremony, so it's going to drag at points, but I really enjoyed the whole thing, even if I got bested in our predictions pool. My Sound Like a Pop co-host Jen beat me again, as she does every time, every single damn time she beats me. But oh well, I enjoyed it. Did you, Holly? Did you stay up and watch, James?
I stayed up to watch the entire thing, which is
wow,
totally unusual for me. But I just happened to be able to pull that off. The people coming through the bus tour, coming through the audience.
Yeah.
I thought went on a little long, but I thought it was really funny and inspired.
Yeah,
and interesting. I sort of feel bad for Matt Damon. How long is the Jimmy Kimmel Matt Damon joke going to play out for before Matt's kind of like?
I mean, they've been doing it for like a decade, and that's what I think a lot of people on Twitter, like, I don't think they realize that this is something that literally happens five nights a week on Jimmy Kimmel's show. Like, I don't know if he still does it. For a long time, he would end every show with, Matt Damon was supposed to be on, but we ran out of time. We'll get him tomorrow. You know, like, that's stuff. Like, this is not like something where they just made this up for the Academy Awards. These two are very good friends. And, you know, Jimmy Kimmel or Matt Damon did a song. What was it? Was it F.U. Jimmy Kimmel? Like, at one point, he did a song with Kimmel's ex-girlfriend, Sarah Silverman. So they've got a good relationship.
Matt Damon.
I censored myself, but if you don't want to, that's your podcast.
I can do that.
But yeah, so I mean, this is something that they are both in on for a long time. Although I do think there were some points at the end when Matt didn't know about some of the jokes, which I think is great too. But I thought overall it was a great night. Broadway, as we always talk about at these awards shows, Broadway tends to show itself really well, whether people recognize it or not. But, you know, between Viola and Kenny Lonergan and Pasek and Paul and then Lynn being there, it was a really great night for Broadway folks.
And their parents.
Well, I think Lynn's mom pretty much won the night.
Didn't she really? I thought so, too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so let's transition into Jay-Z to produce In the Heights film.
Yeah, we're going to stay with Lynn and with the Academy Awards, because on Saturday night at the Weinstein's big pre-Oscars bash at the Montage Beverly Hills Hotel, a handful of, I guess, fairly famous people that have Broadway connections, Tony winner Cynthia Erivo, Tony nominee Chris Jackson, and three-time Broadway alum Corbin Blue, all sang songs from In the Heights. Obviously a big deal because the Weinsteins are going to be producing the In the Heights film adaptation. Corbin Blue, I actually saw him as Zeus Navi on Broadway. Chris Jackson was the original Benny, and I mean, Cynthia Erivo. So anytime you can get her to sing anything, that's awesome. So that's really cool. Also at that party, though, was a couple that I think a lot of people are familiar with, Jay-Z and Beyoncé. And it was announced at that party on Saturday night that Jay-Z will be one of the producers for the In the Heights film. So Hova will be helping bring this movie to the big screen. He's produced Broadway shows before. I think he produced, Stickfly? Is that what it was? Stickfly?
That sounds right, yeah.
That Alicia Keys also produced and stuff. So I think he's produced things for Broadway before. Obviously, everybody in every type of pop culture venue wants to get involved with Lin-Manuel Miranda. So I think this is really cool. And it's nice to know that someone with a big name is getting behind this, so it doesn't fall in development hell like it did last time when they were originally going to make it the first go around. So I think that's awesome. And, you know, you get someone like Jay-Z and Beyoncé behind a film, chances are pretty good that they're not going to scrimp and scrape and do it the wrong way.
All right. Well, you know, scrimping and scraping is not necessarily the wrong thing. Moonlight had a budget of $1.5 million, which is, you know, like a day's of marketing budget for a Star Wars film, you know?
Yeah, it's actually – Moonlight is actually the lowest in terms of inflation adjusted, the lowest budget movie to ever win Best Picture.
And Moonlight's an adaptation of a play.
An unproduced play, but yeah. And what's interesting, if you've seen Moonlight, there are three distinct sections that follow the same character from when he's a child to when he's a teenager to when he's an adult. In the original play by Terrell Alvin McCraney, those three sections were mixed up, so it wasn't until the end that you realized it was all the same person. So they thought him and Barry Jenkins, when they were putting this, you know, transitioning it from a script for the stage to the screen, they said, you know what, I think it actually works better if we do it in three separate vignettes and not intermix them. So it's an interesting story about how that went from an unproduced play to the best picture at the Oscars. I mean, it's a pretty amazing story.
That is really, and what do you think? Do you think that we're going to see this on a stage now that it's won the Academy Award?
I don't know. I mean, it's a very, you know, one of the things that a lot of people were talking about after it won was that, yes, the hubbub and the confusion and the mistake is a big story. But the bigger story is that a film, an independent film about a gay black man won Best Picture. So I think it's a huge story that this was accepted as the Best Picture. There's been, you know, a lot of stories about homosexual characters, but very few have ever gotten this type of acclaim. I don't know that that makes it a good thing to transition to the stage or not. I would be interested to see the original version and see how different that is. But I don't know. It could be. I mean, it didn't exactly make a ton of money at the box office. So I don't know that people are going to be like, oh, that movie, I saw that movie and loved it. You know, I think a lot of the people that saw it are people like me who saw all of them or, you know, are really into, you know, the Academy Awards or people who are really interested about the subject matter. I don't know if we'll see it on stage. I think he's obviously an incredible writer. It's a really powerful story. So I wouldn't hate it, but I don't know that this is one of those slam dunk moneymaker transitions that, you know, we sometimes see from screen to stage.
All right. Tell us about last week's Broadway Grosses.
Well, it was a fairly, you know, average week. It didn't really drop a whole lot. It was down 0.62% from the previous week, which is just about $160,000, with Broadway keeping the same amount of shows. The big, you know, I guess this is kind of redundant at this point. The biggest grosser of the week was Hamilton. But the big story is that it went up $266,609 to again pass the $3 million mark. So it was at $3,133,415. Following that was The Lion King, and that was at $1.86 million. So it wasn't double, but it's getting back to that close thing. The top ticket sold for Hamilton was $849. The average ticket was $291.37. Great googly moogly. Joining Hamilton and The Lion King above seven figures are Wicked, Aladdin, Sunset Boulevard. Again, that's only in seven performances. The Book of Mormon, Dear Evan Hansen, School of Rock, and Natasha Pierre in The Great Comet of 1812. Come From Away, which was just in its second week, it was only seven performances, so it wasn't exactly a full week, but it was over 101% capacity. But its percent of gross potential was only at 63.2%, and it brought it at $601,255 and in seven performances. Not terrible. Obviously, a show that doesn't have a whole lot of name recognition or a lot of star power. They probably sold a lot of cheap tickets, maybe did a little bit of papering before this great word of mouth came out. I would be interested to see how that climbs as people start to see it, and once reviews coming out. I don't think it's going to be that low of gross potential, but I would not be surprised if the attendance numbers stay where it's at. Unfortunately, Significant Other, another one of the newer shows on Broadway, also in its second week, it actually I didn't want to say this in a way like it was a prize for them. They took over the bottom slot in the grosses last week, being about $60,000 less than In Transit. Significant Other brought in $228,247, while In Transit was at $283,384. So again, not a great start for Significant Other, a straight show which doesn't have a whole lot of big stars. I don't know, James, do you feel like you're seeing a lot of ads for this one out there? And those ads are very catchy. Like to me, I don't feel like I've seen a whole lot from Significant Other.
I haven't, no. And this is a tough time of year when all the big shows are gearing up right now for the same eyeballs and the same spaces on websites and print places and other types of venues, advertising venues. So this is an uphill battle for them.
Yeah, it's one that I hope they're able to figure out, but because it's got such an incredible cast with Gideon Glick and Sass Goldberg and Lindsay Mendez and Rebecca Naomi Jones and Barbara Barry. So I hope they're able to figure that out because it's a really good cast. But overall, it's the middle of February, so things aren't great, but they're not awful either. So, you know, I think this is probably a lot of shows being buoyed by this. Even though A Bronx Tale did not pass $1 million this week, it was down 110,000. It was still at 958,000. So pretty good for a show that I think a lot of people probably wrote off before it came into town. And it's doing pretty strong. Waitress continues to do well. Sunday in the Park saw a $37,000 increase, still with its very small houses only at $892,881. You know, so I think overall, James, it's not great, but it could be worse.
All right. Show and casting news. What's going on there?
Well, yesterday, New York City Center announced its 2017 Encores Off-Center season. If you're unfamiliar with Encores Off-Center, it was founded in 2013 with the mission of presenting off-Broadway musicals that pushed creative boundaries when they were first produced. Filtered through the lens of today's artists, these shows are presented not as historical documents, but as living, vital works that continue to resonate with audiences. The first show of the season will be one that I know and love very well. This is one of my favorite shows of all time. It is Stephen Sondheim's Assassins. It will be directed by Anne Kaufman. That will run from July 12th through 15th. The other show in the season is a musical that I have to admit, James, I've never heard of. It is called Really Rosie, and it was written by Carole King and Maurice Sendak. It is going to be directed by the wonderful Lee Silverman. That will run from August 2nd through the 5th. The season will also include a special two-night-only engagement, July 26th and 27th, of Kirsten Child's The Bubbly Black Girl Sheds Her Chameleon Skin, directed by Robert O'Hara. The Encores Off-Center Artistic Director Michael Friedman said, quote, "This season might be called Grown-Ups with Guns, Kids with Dreams, and a Bubbly Girl Trying to Find Her Way Through America." There's a whole lot of that going on in America today, so I think they did a really good job of programming that. But like I said, I love Assassins, James, but it doesn't feel – I mean, I know it's been like 13 years now, but it doesn't feel like we've been without Assassins for that long. Like I'm kind of surprised that that's where they went with this season.
Yeah, it's an interesting season. I'm interested to see how they cast it and what's going on there. There might be other reasons that they have done this. So, but we trust in Encores, Off-Center and the regular Encores.
Yep, so, absolutely.
Do you think that the Sunday in the Park people heard me complain about ticket prices?
No.
Okay.
I don't think they care about what we say one way or the other, James. But whatever it happens to be, yesterday they did announce that for the entire run of Sunday in the Park with George at the Hudson Theater, they will continue the rush policy that they originally set up for the preview period. That means that all of the rush tickets will be just $41 to commemorate the fact that the Hudson Theater is now Broadway's 41st theater. I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's a great thing. It's a small theater. I don't know exactly how many they're going to be, but this is going to be, in my opinion, this is probably going to rival, you know, the Ham for Ham. I mean, it's four times as expensive, but I have a feeling that there's going to be a ton of people for this limited run. It's only scheduled. It must close on Sunday, April 23rd. I feel like as nice of a gesture as this is, I don't think it's going to get nearly as many people in that want to see it.
And the Paper Mill Playhouse announced their 2017-18 season.
I've got to admit, when you know every year Paper Mill Playhouse puts out these like pictures as clues to what their season is, I never have any idea. But I'll tell you, those people over at the Broadway World message boards, they had it figured out in hours. I mean, I don't know if it was everything, but it was pretty darn close. The season is an eclectic mix of new shows, world premieres, classic shows. I'll just run through them real quick. The season will kick off on September 28th, running through October 29th with the world premiere of the Honeymooners musical. It'll be directed by John Rando and choreographed by Joshua Burgass. They work together on the Town. The most recent workshop and lab of this had Hank Azaria, Laura Bell Bundy, Leslie Kritzer, and Michael McGraw in it. Megan Hilty has also been involved at different points. They will follow that up around the holidays with a, I guess, revival of Annie, directed by Mark S. Hobie. And then in January, we'll see the East Coast premiere of Paul Slade Smith's The Outsider. That'll run from January 24th through February 18th. Paul Slade Smith is known more as an actor. He's actually going to be in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, was most recently seen on Broadway as a replacement of Captain Hook in Finding Neverland. Then another world premiere in the spring, March 29th through April 29th, will be the world premiere of the new musical version of the big screen film The Sting, which starred Robert Redford and Paul Newman. That show will also be directed by John Rando, but this time his choreographer will be Tony winner Warren Carlyle. Then we'll see the East Coast premiere of Halftime, which originally was called what was that show originally called, James? Let's Dance or something like that. It's the one that did an out-of-town tryout in Chicago. It's about an adult dance team that tries to win a competition to be the halftime act for a basketball show. It has a book by Bob Martin and Chad Begelin, music by Matthew Sklar, lyrics by Nell Benjamin, with additional music by Marvin Hamlisch and Esther Dean. That will be directed and choreographed by Jerry Mitchell. That's always fun. So it's a really good season, James. A lot of new shows, a classic in there. I have a feeling you're going to be making some treks out to Paper Mill to see all these shows.
Absolutely will be. We love the Paper Mill Playhouse, and it just gets better and better all the time. So the new immersive show from the Sleep No More producers, tell us about that.
Yeah, a new immersive show, Seeing You, is set to debut in New York at a location underneath Chelsea's High Line. The experience, which is billed as narcotic and eye-opening, is created by Randy Weiner, the producer of Sleep No More and the creator of Queen of the Night, along with Ryan Heffington and entertainment venture group Cantora. The show will have a 6-week run starting on May 2nd, and it's going to be at 450 West 14th Street. I guess you're just going to hang out under a bridge for the show, which I guess is cool and maybe a little bit scary, maybe. I don't know.
It used to be a much scarier neighborhood, but it's really nice now. And good restaurants. Yeah. Really good restaurants.
There you
Expensive.
Go. Expensive.
Hard to get reservations.
Well, you better start now.
All right. Laura Osnes and the Bandstand crew have got to find a new place to rehearse, don't they?
Well, they already have, but this is a story you sent me. It came from us, came to us from Forbes. Mark Hirschberg, who seems to be having quite a bit of really strong new theatrical news coming in the last few weeks with his stuff on Isherwood as well. But apparently, the producers of Bandstand are suing Manhattan Ballroom Dance for breach of contract after the studio rescinded their rental agreement 1 month before the start of rehearsals and refused to return the $37,920 in deposits. The Bandstand group is looking to recover its payments as well as interest and legal fees. Last November, apparently, Bandstand agreed to lease this apparently large venue for its rehearsal period between February 20th and March 18th. The contract split the $40,000 rental price into two payments and stipulated that there were no cancellations or refunds after January 20th. But on January 17th, after the musical had paid almost the full rental fee, the rehearsal space canceled their contracts. Bandstand demanded a return of their deposit. Manhattan Ballroom Dance ignored it. And I guess Bandstand just found a new place in a short amount of time. But James, explain to me, you're more into the business stuff than me. If you cancel the contract, you've already taken some money. It seems to me that unless they did something to violate the contract in the first place, you should give the money back, right? What am I missing?
Yeah, I don't think you're missing anything. And that's really a strange thing. And maybe there's more to the story that we're not hearing about. I can't imagine that this if these are all the facts, that this company would think they can get away with it. I'm sure that we'll see a follow-up here. And Mark,
it's just weird.
Yeah, Mark, if you're listening, keep us apprised.
Yeah, because this seems like so like smack my head, like obvious that I feel like there's got to be another shoe to drop so that we understand what's actually going on. But until we find that out, we can just assume that Manhattan Ballroom Dance is just trying to keep the money for themselves, and maybe they're going to run off to Costa Rica or something.
Yeah, you probably had something in the lease that said you're not allowed to dance in the rehearsal space or something like that.
Yeah, Manhattan Ballroom Dance probably does not allow dancing. That's a good point. Hadn't thought of that.
Exactly. All right, why don't you get us out of here?
All right, thanks for listening to Today on Broadway. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @Broadway Radio. You can find me on Twitter @BWWMatt and subscribe to Something Like a Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
And my name is James Marino from BroadwayRadio.com and BroadwayStars.com. Thanks for spending some of your Tuesday with us. We'll be back and talk with you tomorrow.